Welcome to the Your Brain Uncovered podcast, where we discuss science and science-based tools for everyday life. I'm Aya Tarabain. I'm a translational neuroscience student and a researcher at University College London. Also want to emphasize that this podcast is my personal goal of bringing zero-cost-to-consumer information to the general public. It is separate from my other roles. Now, this episode is the second of this show's career series. After listening to it, you'll come to a better understanding of our guest's unique career path. Hopefully, our special guest will provide you with an overview and understanding of what his position entails, his why, and how to follow his footsteps or pave your own unique path, whatever beats your drum. Now, without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Dimitri Panotsis, a professor of computational neuroscience who runs his own lab at the University of London and an alumni of the University of Cambridge. Dr. Dimitri, thank you so much for being here. It's an honor.
Thank you, Aya. It's a pleasure to be here, and I think this is a great initiative.
Thank you. Well, without further ado, can you please tell us a little about your background and how you became interested in neuroscience and computational modeling?
Sure. So I studied physics for my bachelor's, I was always intrigued by mathematics, and how abstract notions develop in our brains, and it generated what makes us, what gives us the unique ability to imagine and to think about words that don't exist on Earth, for example, like literature, right? Or write stories and create technology and create civilization. So I thought, while trying to answer some of these questions to physics, that math is also a good tool for that. So I did a PhD in math after my bachelor's, and I came to this country. I studied in Cambridge, my master's, and I did my doctorate. And then, well, math is brilliant. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. But still, it didn't answer all my, let's say, personal questions that I had in terms of, like I said, what makes us creative, what makes humans special, what gives us the ability to think about all these mathematics that I was doing back then, and the rules and the hidden laws and things like that. So I switched to neuroscience, because in neuroscience, in a sense, in computational neuroscience, what I do now, and I have my lab here in London at the University of London City. I'm also a research affiliate at the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT, where we have also lots of experiments with animals, where we put electrodes in their brains and study all this, you know, all these abstractions and categories and executive control and things like that. I switched to neuroscience to try and get data and develop theories and analyze observations to address this kind of questions that always bothered me. And we have a couple of students in the lab. We do experiments with humans here, electroencephalography. And like I said, we also work with animals.
Wow. Okay, that's quite a unique journey. And I realized how you made you really stand out was the fact that you started off with mathematics. And I hear a lot people go about saying that mathematics is like the music of reason, but I was never really able to resonate with that, especially because of the field that I'm studying. They kind of go like mathematics is the music of reason, but I was never able to resonate with it. Would you be able to really explain to me what really fascinates you about mathematics and how does it link to neuroscience?
Yeah, no, great question. There are several things, right? So one thing is that math is built upon abstraction. And uses lots of our creativity as humans and asks, basically, might motivate us to think whether they really exist in the real world or there are some, you know, universals that are beyond our minds and beyond our world. So these are fascinating questions, especially when one thinks about thinking itself and thinks about understanding themselves, which was, like I said earlier, my earlier motivation, how is abstraction, how is imagination created. So math gives us, you know, it's basically a case study through which we can, you know, turn inwards and do some introspection and understand all these things, or at least to some extent. Now, the other thing why math you know, is useful, of course, is because, you know, it allows us to analyze data, like what we do in neuroscience, and understand ourselves and observe them when we have experiments. So we have, for example, an animal doing a categorization task, thinking about abstract things like, I don't know, up and down, or, you know, different colors, or bright versus dark color. So the animal is doing that. All these things are created in the animal's brain. And then we have observations from that. And then with map, we can analyze these observations and also build theories how all these things happen in our brain. So that's, I think that's what fascinates. It's both things.
Wow. Okay. And as simple as this question might seem, I believe the answer could be a little more complex. But is mathematics something that's discovered or invented? So how do people go about approaching it?
Yeah, well, great question. I think this question has bothered not only me when I was doing my PhD, but, you know, so many people across centuries. Yes. And I don't think there is a, you know, there is a unique answer either way. It can go either way. So it goes back essentially, unsurprisingly, to ancient times. And people like Pythagoras and Plato and Euclid. So like, as you might remember, Plato had this theory of forms and these ideas about an ideal state. And I think Pythagoras also followed suit and agreed with that. And the story goes that Pythagoras, also thought, like Plato, that math exists somewhere. They're objectively true and exist beyond our worlds, beyond our brains. So when he discovered, when Pythagoras discovered the square root of 2, which is the diagonal of a unit square, like a square with unit sides, so he called this number irrational number, which is what we do still, right? We call them numbers like square root of 2, like pi. We call them irrational. They don't make sense. Because, you know, they believed in this idealistic theory of forms, like I said. So in that sense, mathematics, if you adhere to that school of thought, is discovered because it exists somewhere, which is beyond us. So the only thing we have to do is find it. At the same time, again, since ancient times, you had this other school of thought, like Aristotle was somewhere not believing in this objective, you know, this out of the world kind of idea and where the math exists. It was more like a realist, that's how it's called in the literature. But still, believing that math was something objective, but not necessarily out of our world. And then on the other side, again, we have Stoics, and throughout the centuries, we have other people appearing, like the British scholastic philosopher William of Ockham, who believed in other sort of answers to this question. They believed that mathematics is all invention. For example, William of Ockham was what is called a nominalist. So he believed that there are no universal truths, just things that we call them like that, but they are not anything, this is not anything meaningful. And in more recent times, again, like I said, people haven't made up their minds, but still are still bothered by that. Even in modern math research, there's something called foundations of math kind of research or domain. And people like the British philosopher and logician Sir Bertrand Russell, and people from Cambridge like Alfred Whitehead and Ludwig Wittgenstein, they worked on providing axiomatic constructions and proofs of all branches of math based on logic primarily, like I said, including logic, also analysis. So what Euclid in ancient times did with geometry, and we have Euclidean geometry and we have all these axioms, they try to also say, look, math is something objectively true and something that we somehow sort of can prove its existence and discover, not invent. They try to lay down what the axioms are, what the proofs are that gives us this. But again, it's not clear. No, you can say also, of course, when I have these logical axioms and these proofs, I'm inventing all these other fields that, for example, in ancient times didn't exist. So besides geometry, I'm inventing, I don't know, logic or analysis or topology. So again, yeah. That's the bottom line.
Wow.
So if people want to learn more, I would say Google or try to read about, you know, foundations of mathematics. This is how, like I said, called these days.
Well, you really just like took us down a timeline of mathematics, and I guess there's no right or wrong. It's just like different schools of thought. The one where you touched on like Aristotelian realism, I kind of feel like I could resonate with that, you know, because he really emphasizes the science of quantity, I guess, and like and how we can realize mathematical properties in our everyday life, and how mathematics is generally embedded in everything we do and everything we see. I'd like to know about you specifically. Which school of thought do you resonate with the most?
I haven't thought, for your question, I haven't thought a lot about it, but because, I would say, I'm closer to Aristotle's point of view, like the realist view. Which just because it's just somewhere in the middle of believing that mathematics is somewhere and there are universal truths, and also, you know, they're just labels. I don't think it's either or. I think they exist now. Our world, because you can measure, basically you can have a unit square and square with unit sides and then have a diagonal, so it is our world. But of course the fact that it has an infinite number of decimal digits means that you cannot find, you know, it cannot be described within our known universe. There's no space. If you take the whole universe, it's an infinite number. So this kind of, you know, another paradox, right, like this, more paradoxical ideas, means that they're not only part of our world. So that would be more of a reality.
So you've conducted research on a variety of topics related to the brain, from language processing to neurodegenerative diseases. And I'd love to know, which of your research projects have you found most fascinating or rewarding?
I guess there's a recent line of work that I'm doing. Not that recent, but let's say it has picked up more recently. Mm-hmm. Which is on the role of electric fields on understanding how thoughts emerge in our brain, how they basically they control individual neurons. So even experimentalists, you know, the idea is you stick an electrode in the brain, you look at single neuron, single unit, as we call it, activity and spikes. So you show to the animal an image, let's say your face or my face, the animal, you know, reacts, the occipital cortex in the back. But what recent results show is that for thoughts and understanding to emerge in the brain, and memories, for example, to be stored, well, a single neuron is not enough. So the analog I can bring to people to make it, you know, more tangible is the analog of an orchestra, right? So imagine you want to have a symphony, want to play a song, in classical music. If let's say we have a couple of musicians in a room together, it won't be a symphony. There will not be no out, there will be no thought, no memory stuff. So for that to occur, we need to bring many people together. And not only that, we need to have a conductor. We need to have someone that will organize, basically. Sorry, there is some noise.
It's all right. Maybe. You're in London. Can you hear the sirens?
Yeah. So we need to have someone who will basically coordinate activity across the musicians, and someone that the musicians will follow, basically, while playing each one, they're playing their own instrument. So we need some kind of large-scale coordination, or as this is called in physics, like large-scale emergent property, which is this kind of, you know, coherent pattern. So we have recent results showing that that's indeed the case in the brain, that the fields that are generated by neurons are the ones that feed back to them, like the conductor, you know, guiding the musicians, and coordinate the activity of individual neurons. And only when this happens do we have memories and thoughts. So large parts of the brain are activated all the time and doing many, many things, but to have efficient information processing and what we call thought, we need to have this kind of sufficient number of neurons working together and being guided by someone, by some kind of aggregate signal, aggregate information at a higher level than an individual unit.
Where do you hope that this line of research could take us in the future?
Excellent question. it could take us to more efficient, at least my goal would be, or my, let's say, a suggestion I have of putting it up also in the community or even on LinkedIn, and I've talked to companies, if it could give us better brain-computer interfaces and allow us to treat diseases and paralysis of people with stroke or disabled people, because essentially what happens, right, in this kind of neurological disorders or other conditions like that, is parts of the brain are basically cannot work. You can't use them. So it could be structural damages or functional damages, so neurons don't work, don't respond. or at least some kind of deterioration of the brain matter, of the gray and white matter in the brain. And they cannot generate these thoughts, they cannot generate these commands, like move their hands, for example, if you are paraplegic. So the way brain-computer interfaces work at the moment is they try to stimulate these areas, you know, some kind of electrical music, feedback to the brain, at least in closed-loop brain stimulation, that's what we try to do. So basically what we do is we'll alter their energy state of that region that is pathologic but cannot function using basically electrical stimulation. But we don't have a good understanding, we don't dissociate so far between spikes and currents of single units and also the aggregate, the ensemble field, this aggregate property. So what happens, you know, in a top-down way, like we don't care a lot, we don't know what the conductor is in this case.
Yeah.
So we need this kind of approach where it's put the emphasis on the conductor to build more efficient brain-computer interface for clinical application. Okay. I'm not saying that people should walk around wearing, you know, a brain suit. I think that, yeah, I'm interested in, you know, like a clinical and ethical application. This is an important aspect.
I mean, you never know in this world today, anything is possible.
It's always like that, the science and the knowledge, but I think it's also the responsibility of the people to think about things, the scientists themselves, to, you know, to make sure that all these things are used for a good purpose.
Of course, I mean, you as a scientist hold a lot of power in terms of where we end up as humans in one way or another. And what do you think are some ethical considerations that any scientist should have in mind when he's in a position of power? Yeah, what do you think are some ethical considerations that we should all have in mind?
I mean, it's the I'd say that it's not different from any kind of experiment and application, what we just discussed about the brain-computer interface. It's not different from anything, you know, that happens in psychology or, you know, neuroscience, in classical neuroscience. So we always have these principles of do no harm, of benevolence. So whatever we develop should not limit or constrain personal freedom, or should not interfere with choices that we have as individuals. And there should always be transparency there and informed consent of individuals and before they benefit of the society as a whole, right? And also remember that we are all funded most often, or to large part, for this research by, you know, public money, by public organizations. So which is tax money, so we have responsibility towards the taxpayer. But even if when that's not the case, we have private money, still our research impacts society. So I think we're all mindful that we should be thinking about the common good.
Of course. If we were to
that's why I was emphatic about clinical application.
Oh, a lot of emphasis on the clinical application, of course, because that's where we want to end up, right? You just want to move it from like the bench or your desk, if you're a computational neuroscientist, to the bedside. So you've done a lot of work on EEG. And if you were to take a bird's eye view, do you believe that maybe brain imaging can answer our deep questions about, you know, the complexity of human abilities? Is that possible?
Yes, so it's already doing that, luckily.
Wow.
As I'm sure you know. Maybe it's sometimes it's not as publicized for good reasons, because it involves, for good or worse, it involves animal research.
Okay.
And I know for sure, because I've worked in these labs, I still have collaborations, that animals are treated following very strict guidelines. We care about animal welfare, but still it's something that, you know, sticking electrodes, we don't do that in the brain of humans for good reasons, but we still do that in the brain of animals and monkeys in particular. And the reason we do that, going back to your question, is because this is the only way to understand the details of the biology and understand how, for example, complex thinking and imagination, and like I said, abstract thoughts are emerging in the brain. And we have lots of understanding. We can record neurons that represent, for example, like I said, categories and rules, and even, you know, plans. And this is the way. So brain imaging, I work a lot, like you said, with and data, is a microscope, a real microscope into the brain, like ours, from non-human primate. that is, let's say, at the same sort of a very, very similar level in terms of cognitive abilities. So yeah, I think it's the only way for us to observe our own internal theory of, you know, and world or ideal state, let's say, of ideas, the state of ideas. And like Plato's, I don't know if it, like Plato, we can say that all these things in math and all these abstract things exist somewhere else, but we can definitely find how they exist in our own brains.
Okay, wow.
And this is the only way, so that's why I'm interested in that. Nobody wants to behave badly to any other creature, I think.
Most certainly.
Like Socrates would say, the benevolence principle.
Of course. And what would you, since this is part of the career series, what advice would you give to any individual who's interested in pursuing a career in computational neuroscience specifically?
I think they need to have a broad background.
Mm-hmm.
Because the field is interdisciplinary. So, of course, at the same time, they need to, which is a general advice, by the way, they need charity for all people, not younger people around. We live in a world that there's so much information, many things need, for example, for computational neuroscience, many different kinds of knowledge, you know, stats, maybe math, maybe, you know, psychology and neuroscience and behavior and neurology. So, but at the same time, we live in a world where we have all these, you know, stimuli, you have Twitter, you have LinkedIn, you have whatever. We're all bombarded with information, and some of this we need to use. So the general advice, I guess, which applies also to some of our studies, pick carefully what they want to pay attention. So you need to have some sort of deep thinking, let's say. You need to have some sort of focus to succeed. And this is hard to do in this world because there's so much information, like I said, many resources, and many places where we're getting information from. And also many things needed to take a step further and go forward.
Okay, so from what I understand from that is that for you to be able to master something, it's not about acquiring as many specialties as you possibly can, but about being able to say no to as much as you possibly can. So you go through like an elimination method of all the distractions or side projects that you think are relevant but are really not. And then you just focus on doing deep work in one certain discipline. And then your advice for going to any field, not just computational neuroscience, is to really focus on the idea of doing interdisciplinary work because no man's really an island and you can't do much alone. So whether you go into computational neuroscience or maybe evolutionary psychology, you're going to be working with biostatisticians and various stakeholders and policymakers at the end of the day if you want your work to get somewhere, which I believe is very, very relevant advice that I should be listening to as well. So thank you very much.
Summarized it very beautifully. Yeah, I think these are all great points.
Oh, thank you.
And I'd say that this generation, you know, if I were starting again now, I started many years ago, but it's a bigger challenge than what we had, like previous generation, because we didn't have all these, you know, distractions, which on the one hand is, like you said, you know, picking and being, you know, deciding what to say no. It also needs some, you know, greater emotional strength, because all these different distractions and side projects can also create some sort of uncertainty, put more stress on people. So yeah, it's also about, you know, developing some resilience in terms of how we handle the loss of information, challenges, and opportunities at the same time.
Well, yeah, I do agree with the fact that multitasking is a myth. It's just easier to say and far more difficult to really apply that to ourselves. It's I would love to know, how is it that you go about balancing your research with other responsibilities as a scientist?
Excellent question. I think a lot about this because it's a great challenge for all of us. By trying to train myself to say no, mm-hmm. to prioritize things and put a very strict, but not, you know, in an oppressive way, but strict time limits about which tasks I do every day. So, and before I start my day, like today, for example, I make a plan of, you know, what I have to do, what is most important, where should I involve most of my energy, when during the day, because, for example, maybe later I would be more tired, for example, so I try to stack or reading my emails and responding to them for later in the day. But again, by being very disciplined, I would say, and trying to devote some of my time to think about the things that I should say no to.
Okay.
That's your earlier point. Yeah, so that's important. Very important, I would say. And also, when something goes, again, another advice I would call, sort of personal experience, when something goes wrong, because it's a new thing, you know, we didn't know, something new pops up, a new kind of responsibility. It's fine if people make mistakes. I think everybody makes mistakes. We can't plan everything, because things, we live in such a dynamic world, and we're bombarded, like I said earlier, with new information. So it would go wrong eventually. But that's
I do agree with the fact that multitasking is a myth. It's just easier to say and far more difficult to really apply that to ourselves. It's I would love to know, how is it that you go about balancing your research with other responsibilities as a scientist?
By trying to train myself to say no, mm-hmm. to prioritize things and put a very strict, but not, you know, in an oppressive way, but strict time limits about which tasks I do every day. So, and before I start my day, like today, for example, I make a plan of, you know, what I have to do, what is most important, where I should involve most of my energy, when during the day, because, for example, maybe later I would be more tired, for example, so I try to stack or reading my emails and responding to them for later in the day. But again, I being very disciplined, I would say, and trying to devote some of my time to think about the things that I should say no to.
Okay.
That's your earlier point. Yeah, so that's important. Very important, I would say. And also, when something goes, again, another advice I would call, sort of personal experience, when something goes wrong, because it's a new thing, you know, we didn't know, something new pops up, a new kind of responsibility. It's fine if people make mistakes. I think everybody makes mistakes. We can't plan everything, because things, we live in such a dynamic world, and we're bombarded, like I said earlier, with new information. So it would go wrong. Yeah, there is this famous quote, you know, it doesn't matter how many times or how many punches you get from some old movies, you know, the Rocky movies, maybe you guys don't know them. But anyway, so what matters is how many times you fall and get back up. So that would be, so resilience is key. And this is something that we all have to practice. And it applies to science as well.
Yeah, that's quite true. You know, there's this Stanford professor, his name is Andrew Huberman, and he always says that you're either forward center of mass or you're backward center of mass. When you're backward center of mass, it's you fail and it takes your time to clean your mess up and bounce back. But when you're forward center of mass, you hop onto the next thing and you build on that trial of error. So yeah, I think that's a skill we need to all hone in on, especially because in science there's a lot of failed experiments, rejected papers, and then eventually the breakthrough. I'm curious to know what really motivates you every day. So what's your why? Not in a bigger picture, but when you wake up every day and you go in and you have a very, very long day, what is it that kind of drives you forward?
One thing is, as you might imagine, from what we said already, the fact that if I can, you know, with my day-to-day job, get answer a little bit this kind of bigger question, right? How do I build, for example, efficient PCIs to treat and help paraplegics or people with, disabled people? Or how can I come up with some ideas to have this personalized medicine approach? So that's one reward. The other thing is I like teaching and interacting with younger people. And when you can transfer a little bit of your knowledge or experience, precisely what we tried to do in the last half an hour, and help people reach happiness or their goals a little bit faster by not repeating my mistakes and also telling them it's okay if you make mistakes like I just did. So that's also very rewarding. I guess. That these are main things, interactions specifically with students, and also trying to contribute the knowledge that we have as a community and as a scientific community regarding these questions.
Well, it sounds to me that your day looks like a series of good intentioned acts. So I hope that I could build a life or a career that is like that. Thank you so much for your time and for helping us all and sharing your insight. It was honestly a pleasure, and I really hope to have you here on another episode as well. Well, for all you listeners out there, I provided in the show notes a link to Dr. Dimitri's website and his academic profile alongside any socials available. Please feel free to reach out if you have any further questions and leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. Thank you for listening, and more importantly, thank you for your interest in science. Goodbye.